It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, and today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we catch Badger basketball fever as the team makes the Final Four.
First, today is the official deadline to sign up for health insurance at healthcare.gov, but the website has been experiencing severe glitches, and there have been several federal and state extensions for healthcare enrollment.
Now that we've reached the official deadline, we're looking at how the Affordable Care Act has gone politically in Wisconsin. While the technological problems will prevent analysts from getting an accurate picture of who signed up, at this point we're looking at how successful the law has been in the political realm.
We have a political scientist with us, Tim Dale, assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse.
Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start, we said we weren't going to focus too much on the technical glitches, but today's news headlines sort of make that impossible. Could these technical problems have happened at a worse time for Obamacare?
Well, they could have. They could have happened right as Obamacare was rolling out, but as we know, that happened as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the worst times for technical problems would have been right at the beginning and right at the end. And as luck or fate would have it, that's exactly what we saw.
So in terms of the politics of all this, how has let's go with the technical glitches because it is in the news today. How have those technical glitches been playing out politically? And given what is happening today, how likely is it that we're going to see them continue to play out for the remainder of the election season?
Well, the thing about these technical glitches, and it seems like a lot of them have been technological ones, so keeping a website up and going with the amount of traffic that they've had and maintenance issues, I think it's really a public relations and a political issue more than it is an actual feasibility issue. And part of the reason is it feeds into the arguments that are critics of the Affordable Care Act, which is that from a conservative perspective, government programs don't work. Government is inefficient and unviable solution to problems. And so it feeds into the narrative that conservatives have had from the beginning, which is that this isn't going to work. Now, the actual logistics of getting people health care coverage is kind of a separate issue. So whether or not the website works, there's going to be the question about whether or not people are actually insured and whether that lowers the prices for people. And then there's the other issues of pre-existing conditions and enrollment questions. But the thing about these technical problems is that it feeds into the debate. And, of course, on the political left, the argument for why the Affordable Care Act is a good idea has nothing to do with whether or not the website works. It has to do with actually getting people covered. So I think that we're going to see this be an ongoing issue because it feeds into the baseline narratives from each side politically. But I think the overall evaluation of the Affordable Care Act will be something that we're talking about for several years, and it will have less to do with the website and more to do with the actual enrollment.
Yeah, you've touched on those baseline narratives, but we're going to be hearing a lot more of them in the coming months. So let's start out with the Democrat sort of baseline narrative for the coming months. Now, there's going to be a lot of Democrats, I think, who may try to distance themselves somewhat from Obamacare because of the technical glitches. But for many of them, it's going to be a difficult walk because they may have voted for it in the first place.
Absolutely. And I think with midterm elections coming up this year, the question for Democratic candidates is whether or not they're going to be playing offense or defense when it comes to the Affordable Care Act. And this is the luxury, but also the cost of having a president from your party in office, is that you kind of live and die by the president's policies as party leader. And so it may be difficult for some Democrats if the traction is against the Affordable Care Act in their own district. They're going to have to be spending a lot of time talking about it, justifying it. I think it'll be very difficult for Democrats to run away from it and not talk about it, because my guess is Democratic opponents are going to be talking about it as much as they can. So I think Democrats we're going to see much more be up trying to be in front of the issue and justify why it is that they voted for it, for example, or why it is that they think it's a good idea.
And at the same time, on the flip side of that, the Republican narrative, as I understand it, very much what you alluded to earlier, maybe the centerpiece of some of their elections come this fall, and the premise being that, you know, if they can't even get the website right, what do you think the rest of the program is going to look like?
Right. That's exactly the argument that they're going to use. And for this, it's really going to be about who controls the narrative. So if Republicans are out in front with all of the problems that have happened, and there have been some embarrassing problems related to the rollout of the Affordable Care Act and this, particularly the insurance exchange that Obama has been promoting. If that argument gets traction, that's going to be a pretty easy argument to illustrating the point the Republicans make that goes to the deeper question about whether or not it's government's job or whether government's effective at solving these kinds of social problems.
So when are some of these decisions about the baseline narratives for the upcoming elections going to be made? I mean, at some level, they've got a bunch of options out there, I imagine, on both parties about if this happens, then we'll do that and so forth. But is there a point when they're going to have to commit and make a decision about this is the line we're going to take?
I think so. And I think Republicans have already made that commitment. I think that any evidence that there have been problems with any of the logistics of rolling out or any of the actual enrollments, I think that's where the Republicans are going to go. I think the Democrats are going to be in a bit of a predicament coming in the next few months because their argument is going to rely on some longer-term data in terms of who is enrolled, whether or not this enrollment has lowered the cost overall. Insurance companies are going to be more or less happy with this depending on the amount of risk that they've put into the policies that they've sold. And so I think that in order for Democrats to make the argument about the feasibility and workability of these programs, I think that that's going to take a little bit longer. And so the offense the Democrats are going to have to play is going to be in anticipation of these things, just talking about the raw numbers, you know, 6 million have enrolled through the website. That kind of thing is probably going to be where Democrats go for the next couple of months.
And you bring up that interesting point about the delay in getting some other numbers in terms of the legislation's actual effectiveness. As you say, we'll have some numbers about the, you know, how many people signed up and what sorts of plans they may have gotten and all that sort of thing. But in terms of whether it actually works and does what it's supposed to do or turns out to be a failure, we're really not going to have those answers for some time. And so these narratives are going to be running in the absence of all that.
Absolutely. And what Democrats have argued from the beginning and what Obama has wanted from the beginning is the bottom line number of more Americans are insured than have been previously. And for at least for the exchange and the policies that are being sold, they're not even necessarily asking about whether or not someone has been previously insured. And so those numbers are going to have to come through polling. They're going to have to come through other kinds of data. And so I think for a victory to be declared by Obama, it's probably going to take a maybe even a whole year or more to really get a sense of how the insurance industry has been affected by this. But I think the overall question of more people being insured is where a lot of Democrats are going to go with their arguments.
Now, we've been talking a lot about what politicians might be looking at and how they're going to spin this. But do you have any idea of what actual people think about the law so far? You know, obviously, we don't have any numbers that reflect what's happening today, probably. But in general, as they've been signing up and maybe learning more about it, do we have a better sense of what the public actually thinks?
Well, this is what it's an excellent question, and I think this is one of the questions that we'll have going forward, is that right now the narrative is being controlled largely by politicians, by the political argument. So if people are against the Affordable Care Act, it doesn't matter how many people enrolled, they're still going to make arguments against it and vice versa for it. I think this is one of those consumer-based programs where we are going to get data over the next several months about the actual experience that people are having with their insurance. Right now, it's largely anecdotal. One person says that they have been able to afford insurance that they've never had before. Another person says that they're paying more in premiums than they would for a doctor. But those are all anecdotal. I think that your question will be answered as people actually consume these insurance products. And those are answers that we're going to get. And I think that the politicians aren't really going to have control over those messages. If the Affordable Care Act works, we're going to get those answers. If it doesn't work, people are going to be dissatisfied.
We're talking to political scientist Tim Dale about how politically successful the Affordable Care Act has been so far.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think President Obama's health care law has been a success? Is it too early to say? Tell us what you think. And did you sign up for health insurance on the healthcare.gov website? What was your experience like? You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our discussion right now on how successful President Obama's health care law has been so far with political scientist Tim Dale.
And we're taking your calls on the health care law. Do you think President Obama's Obamacare law has been a success? Why or why not? And did you sign up for health insurance on the healthcare.gov website? What was it like? Are you letting the glitches influence your opinion of whether the law is good or bad? Give us a call. Share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org. We've got some callers who'd like to join in, but before we do that, Tim Dale, I'd like to ask you, in terms of politics around the country, do you see shifts from state to state in terms of the popularity or unpopularity of the law? Like in Wisconsin, for example, what's it look like here?
Yeah, well, we're definitely seeing differences around the country, and at least right now, because of most of the messaging around this has been related to those political things we were talking about earlier. We really see that more conservative states are having more negative reactions, more liberal states are having more positive reactions, and even in states that are moderate, where there are conservatives in charge of government, Republicans in charge of government, obviously we're seeing governmental officials who are suspicious of the president's policies. So I think we definitely are seeing some variance in the country, but in a place like Wisconsin, I think we're seeing at least so far a fairly split decision on whether or not the Affordable Care Act is a good thing or a bad thing.
So no real surprises there, it sounds like.
No.
Let's go to the phones right now, find out what listeners have to say about this. We begin with Jessica, and Jessica joins us from West Bend. Hi.
Hi. I guess I wanted to say that my husband and I enrolled in the Affordable Care Act through the website, and we did run into some glitches, but, I mean, everything worked out. I was able to call and get everything all finalized. But my biggest disappointment is that prior to signing up, we were on BadgerCare because my husband was the insurance carrier and lost his job. And our insurance through the Affordable Care Act, even though we selected a silver plan, is still going to cost us more than BadgerCare, and it's going to cover a lot less. So for us, that's going to hit us financially, quite a bit harder than I had anticipated. So I'm still hopeful that it's going to be a great positive change for the country, but for my family personally, it's hitting our pocketbook a little hard.
Jessica, thanks a lot for that call. And Tim, let's talk about that for a second, because in Wisconsin, as in many other states, there were decisions made about exchanges and changes in other insurance programs. And here, of course, there were significant changes in BadgerCare. Is that likely to be part of the debate when it comes to the governor's race or maybe other state races this fall?
Absolutely. And I think anyone on both sides of the aisle would agree that any time there's a market that's out there, like the insurance market, the healthcare market, there are many different policies at the state level and the national level that we're trying to fill in the gaps. And one of the things Obama was aiming for, and the Democrats were aiming for, was a way to address a whole range of problems. And the experience your caller talks about is definitely going to be an experience that's shared by a lot of people, where you had a previous program or plan in place, and then the trade-off for individual people might be better or worse. I think these are the stories that are definitely going to be part of the argument. And I think overall the evaluation is whether or not the Affordable Care Act sufficiently traded off with these other plans, or whether people are overall perceiving a lack of policy service. And I think that the story that your caller had is telling for the experience that some people are having. But then there are also other people who are having good experiences with it, paying less money. So I think anytime you have a program that does something with a market, you're going to have those different examples. I think the question is overall, how effective is it going to be when you take everyone's story into account?
Now, here in Wisconsin, Governor Walker made the decision not to go with a state-run exchange and opted instead for the federal exchange. Is that likely to be an issue in the campaign, or is that just so much minutia that isn't going to matter to the average voter?
I don't think it's going to matter to the average voter. I think Walker is going to be able to distance himself. I don't think anyone's going to accuse him of being an Obama ally. I think that governors and states have had to make decisions about where to go, and it could be a political issue. I think if there are state exchanges, that might be a victory flag for somebody. But in the case of Wisconsin, I'm not sure that this is going to come up very much in the governor's race, at least insofar as Walker's decision to go with the national exchange.
800-642-1234 if you would like to join in the discussion. Christopher joins us now from Heartland. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think it's going reasonably well considering that there's such opposition and obstructionism from the other side. If everybody worked together to do something great, it probably would be wonderful right now. I mean, just the last administration went to two wars and was a bungled mess, and it still is to this day. And so for them to say that things are horrible, that's so disingenuous. So I'm optimistic. I signed up last night. I hope it gets to be universal health care eventually, though. Thank you.
Christopher, thanks for the call. And Tim, let me follow up on that by asking, you know, he brought up the whole idea of that there's been sort of one side. It's been, you know, a Democratic initiative. Is it possible for this law to be truly successful without getting any support at all from across the aisle?
I think it is, although the question is going to be just like any other government program, how many people are buying into it, and does it become something that is just accepted as a matter of fact? So let's say that the insurance exchanges work and the more people are insured, I think you might see Republicans moving in the direction of just accepting that it's a good idea. If it's a total catastrophe and it doesn't work out and more people are not insured, I think you'll see more Democrats just admitting that it was a bad idea or ineffectually implemented. So I think that overall, I think we will see across the aisle movement on this, but I think that the data is going to drive that, whether or not it's working or not working. And in history, if history is any indication, it's that if something works, it gets consensus support, and if it doesn't, then everyone decides it's a bad idea.
So maybe in 40 or 50 years, we'll be looking back at it as either a noble experiment that failed or a success story in the sense of, like Social Security, where there's broad support for it.
I think so. And actually, that's another issue that was raised by the caller. I think that the Affordable Care Act may end up playing a large role in how we evaluate the Obama presidency, in part because he ran on the position of reforming health care. And the Affordable Care Act was passed in his first term, and then in the second term we see implementation. I think if in 20 or 30 years, it may not even take that long, if more people are insured and we look at health insurance more like auto insurance, where everyone has it and it's just a fact of life, I think that's going to be part of the Obama legacy. If this was a failed attempt at doing that or accomplishing that, I think that will be a big part of Obama's legacy. And I think the administration knows that, which is why we have so much emphasis on it and why it's such a big story today.
But the problem with legacy for a lot of politicians is that implies it's a long way away. So how does that help me in the midterms? How does that help me in 2016?
Exactly. And that's a big question for people who are running in the fall.
Let's go to Cindy right now, and Cindy is with us from Cresco, Iowa. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to add that we had just a fantastic experience getting signed up. You know, we had thought about it and looked at it for probably since December. You know, we've just sort of been looking at it and wondering. And then I went on the website one day, and there was a local help listed. And so I simply called that person up, went to his office, and it took no more than 20 minutes, you know, to get it all signed up. We had an idea of what we wanted to go with, but it was really nice to have that person available, you know, just to make sure that we got everything done correctly. And for us, as far as coverage goes, it will be wonderful because we've always had to have a very high deductible so that we can have lower monthly premiums. Because I have had cancer twice, and so we bought our insurance policy 30 years ago when we were first married, and so, you know, all these things happen over the years, so we never really could go back and be, have them evaluate our policy again. So for me, it'll be wonderful because I can go on and get the same kind of coverage that, you know, anybody can. And
Cindy, thanks so much for the call. And Tim, that brings up the question, you know, we've heard some stories about how it helps individual people, but, you know, that big question of whether the country can afford it is one that a lot of people are still asking.
Right. And I think that we're probably, for that question, going to have to wait until the insurance industry completely evaluates it. One of the political issues about this is I don't know if we remember the primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, but Obama was running on the market-based solution, and Hillary was arguing for a kind of a more comprehensive government plan. And so what we get from Obama is a partnership between the government and the free market, hence these exchanges that we have. And I think that in that partnership, we're going to have to wait to see if that kind of combination hybrid between government and the market is really going to produce the results. But I think the affordability in your question about whether or not it helps the whole country, that's the data that we're going to be looking at.
All right. Lots to think about. Thanks so much for being with us, Tim.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Tim Dale, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse, and he joined us for this half hour to talk about how the Affordable Care Act is faring politically. And now it's time for a little celebrating as the UW-Madison Badgers basketball team are just two games away from winning a national championship.
In an overtime thriller, Wisconsin beat Arizona last Saturday night to advance to the Final Four. It's the first time they've done so since the year 2000.
And we are joined now by the very versatile Chuck Quirnbuck. He is WPR's reporter based in Milwaukee, who we just heard from. But Chuck also has tickets to the Final Four, and we'll be talking to him in just a second. We'd like to hear from you, too, though. How excited are you that the Badgers have made it this far, the first time since 2000? And what do you expect in the next game and then, hopefully, the game after that? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also post comments on the Central Time Facebook page. 800-642-1234. And let's go now to Chuck. And Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon, and we should say self-funded tickets unless I sell them.
I have to ask, you know, last week I was hearing a lot of conversation about whether people were going to buy the tickets or not. So were you in the – did you have faith, you know, 2-3 weeks ago that you'd be sitting in this position right now?
I did cover for WPR and Michigan Radio a couple weekends ago, some regional games in Milwaukee. Wisconsin played American and Oregon, and there were other schools there, of course. And, boy, the Badgers looked pretty good in those games, came back in a surge to beat Oregon, and played solid defense. And so when they went out west and beat Baylor in Arizona, maybe a little bit less confident that they'd do well there. But after watching the Baylor game Thursday, again, quite impressive. And then things just fell right for the Badgers over Arizona.
But I have to say, and you were watching the game on Saturday, I assume.
Right, on either TV or I think it was perhaps a NCAA website is carrying it as well.
So let me ask you about your fingernails. Do you have any left? Because I think a lot of people were gnawing at them. It was a tough game to watch. I had some friends I was watching the game with. They actually had to turn away from the television during overtime because they couldn't take the pressure.
Well, I tell you, as someone who's watched Badger basketball going back to the 1960s and survived many, many years, including when I was a student in Madison, not so great results. I think just to see them in the Elite Eight, in the Sweet 16, anything like that is a plus. And whether they went beyond that or not, it was, you know, who cares? They got this far and played well.
And as I understand it, here at the UW-Madison campus, there was sort of just a massive outpouring of everyone running toward State Street into the cold weather. I guess it was a little cold that day, and people didn't have their jackets on. They were just tearing off. Chuck, how did you celebrate?
Saturday night, I was watching. I was bowling with our television folks as well, and we celebrated at a site in Monona. And then I did go downtown and briefly crossed State Street. Did not need to hang around that too many of those times. Other gatherings in years past, but I tried to avoid State Street. But apparently it was relatively calm, some climbing on scaffolding, I read, nowhere near the more serious things that went on in Arizona after the team lost there. There was many more arrests and so on.
And we want to hear from you, Wisconsin, on this. Are you excited about the Badgers basketball win and advancing to the Final Four? Did you celebrate? Were you afraid to watch? Are you excited about basketball here in Wisconsin? It's not quite as popular as football, I gather. But basketball, this is a pretty exciting thing for the Badgers here. What do you think? 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Chuck, Wisconsin started the regular season strong. They struggled a bit after that. And while they ended up with a number two seed, are you surprised they made it this far?
Well, again, they teams often in pro sports or college athletics, and some people do say there's an overlap. Anyway, teams often, if they start out well and they slump, maybe they learn something along the way, correct some errors in their strategy and personnel, and then get back on their roll. And that's what the Badgers have done now. They're on the sort of second upswing. Whether that could, which could end at any time. Kentucky, the Badgers' opponent on Saturday in Dallas or in Arlington, Texas, looked pretty strong there in beating Michigan. So it'll be a stern test for the Badgers.
There have been a lot of narratives running through this run towards the Final Four, and Bo Ryan being one of the big narratives. In your estimation, there was a lot of debate last week. I saw, is he really a great coach or isn't he, and all that sort of thing. What's your take on Bo Ryan?
Well, his record of getting to the Badgers to the postseason, I think more than a dozen years in a row, speaks something. He was a gentleman that coached, I think he was an assistant at Madison long ago. Then he went out, I believe, to Platteville, won there, did well there, and was brought back. He's very solid. He, in news conferences after the Milwaukee games, was, of course, happy that teams had won, but maintained an air of seriousness, that they had to correct certain things and would correct certain things. He appears to have total buy-in from the players. He can be very tough on them, yanking them out of the games after turnovers and so on, but putting them back in and appearing that, by and large, to treat the players well.
Well, Chuck, thanks a lot for coming on to talk Badgers basketball, and have fun at the game.
Unless I sell the tickets, yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, that was WBR's reporter Chuck Kornbach, based in Milwaukee.
Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Legendary monsters and spirits live wherever there are people to tell their tales, including Wisconsin. Artist Mike Bass tells us about the Wisconsin folklore that inspire his artwork.
I've always been interested, I guess, in stories that relate to the supernatural or just things unknown. I found a lot of articles around the turn of the century, 1800s to the 1900s, about a monster in Lake Mendota. It was actually a monster that was seen in all five lakes, but primarily in Mendota. It ranged from 35 feet to 70 feet, depending on the person who was explaining it. They all said it had a horse-like face. Some said it was menacing, some said it was friendly. In some cases, it caused harm and did damage, tipped over boats, ate small animals that were swimming too far offshore. And in other instances, it, tickled people's feet while they were swimming or laying on the shore. So it was kind of funny. So I did three prints in the first series: the Lake Mendota Monster, the Wendigo, and then also the Witches of Picnic Point. I didn't put the horse-like face on Mendota Monster. I kind of gave him my own interpretation, but he was definitely serpentine long and had kind of scales and fins. The Wendigo, I kind of adapted a lot of images of him that I've seen based on, just artist representations and then how the native culture actually depicted him. He was kind of a gaunt, tall creature and oftentimes has horns in the face of a deer, which was kind of neat to me. And then the Witches of Picnic Point, they're supposed to be hackberry trees. And if you've ever seen a hackberry tree, they kind of just have that really warty and bumpy kind of bark that's really kind of characteristic of that tree. Art has always been a big part of what I do. The history, I don't know, I just like to know things, I think. So I've always been a digger and a scratcher and looking into things. I grew up in Wisconsin. I've been here my whole life. I listen to my family tell stories, about these things. My father had a long line of friends and kind of jokesters and tricksters, and they all would tell stories, when they gathered around in the basement. My mom's family also just had lots of different stories. They grew up on, her folks grew up on a farm in southwestern Wisconsin, so it was kind of that connection to rural America and just scary things that happened in the very, very dark. there's a bounty of stories in Wisconsin folklore. There's just a bounty of stories of just weird and strange occurrences in Wisconsin. So, you know, I mean, everybody loves a good story. We do have a very rich mythology. I would have to disagree with anybody that would say we don't.
Mike Bass is an artist and associate creative director at Knupp & Watson in Madison. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council.
And while Wisconsin may not be famed for Bigfoot sightings, we've got plenty of monsters and plenty of mysteries that have sparked the same kind of lore Mike Bass shared with us. So from the vampire of Mineral Point to the phantom chickens of Chicken Alley, Chad Lewis joins us now to share some of those stories. He is a Wisconsin-based paranormal researcher and the author of Unexplained Research. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, glad to be here.
You know, we heard from Mike Bass just a few minutes ago, and he said, you know, that we do have a rich mythology here in Wisconsin. And from where you sit, you know, how do we compare to other states? Are we about average in terms of these stories, or are there pockets around the country where you hear more of these things than others?
Actually, Wisconsin seems to be a hotbed for these monsters and stories. I've traveled the world collecting these stories, and every state, every region has their own uniqueness. But there's something about Wisconsin, whether people feel more comfortable coming forward with it or there's more researchers collecting it, but we do have just a great amount of weird tales.
And so if we are looking at sighting monsters or having some of those weird tales, if you look at a map of Wisconsin, are they sort of evenly spread throughout the state, or do you find them in one place more than another?
If you take a map of Wisconsin and throw a dart anywhere, you will find somewhere that has a monster story. And that's the beauty of it. You can be way up in the North Woods and do some Bigfoot research. You can be in Madison, as we just heard, and do some sea serpent research. You can be on the west side. You know, even up in Door County, you'll have more than you could ever possibly imagine.
So do the monsters that we have, are they scary, creepy monsters, or are they just interesting, sort of friendly monsters, or do they cover the waterfront?
A little bit of both. When we look at the Beast of Bray Road down in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, which is Wisconsin's werewolf creature, that seems to be, you know, this tall, mashed down fur, long snout, really terrifying creature for witnesses that see it. But then when you compare that with the phantom chickens of Chicken Alley, that seems to me more of a fun and just kind of goofy and really odd, you know, these chickens that appear and then disappear right before your eyes.
Yeah, you must tell me more about the phantom chickens of Chicken Alley, because I've lived in Wisconsin my entire life, and I've never heard of the phantom chickens, ever.
Not too far from Green Bay is a small town called Seymour. Out in the middle of nowhere is this small stretch of road aptly named Chicken Alley.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, people have been driving down, and all of a sudden, they believe to have run over real chickens. They see them, they hit them, they get out to discover the roadkill and the damage, only to find that there's nothing there. Others told me that they actually saw these chickens disappear right before their eyes, and they leave the area believing they've run over those phantom chickens.
So any, you know, really sort of creepy clucking or anything that takes place, or that's kind of a noise-free experience?
Yeah, most of the people that have had the experience are so convinced that they've run over something that's a flesh and blood creature that some have even gone door to door on the half a dozen or so homes that are on the road asking if anyone's raising chickens. And of course, it's farm country, but nobody has chickens. So they're really puzzled as to what happened to them.
Let's move on to some other monsters, because we've got plenty to talk about, including Pepe, and this sounds like a friendly monster, the Lake Pepin Sea Serpent.
Yes, if you're looking for spring to spring forward and go out, head over to Lake Pepin, which of course is on the Mississippi River, bordering Wisconsin and Minnesota. Dating back to the 1800s, we have newspaper accounts of this large monster, sea serpent for lack of a better term, in Lake Pepin. And the people of Lake City, Minnesota are so convinced that Pepe's real, they're offering a $50,000 reward for anyone who can capture evidence of it.
$50,000? Okay, I know
what
I'm doing this weekend.
All you have to do is catch it.
Yeah, all I got to do is catch it, huh? Okay. All right. So I'm going to make a trip over to Lake Pepin, Lake City, and catch up with Pepe. So has Pepe been documented? I mean, all the way along, there have been newspaper articles for the last 150 years or whatever?
Yes. Well, we know there are Native American legends about any time anyone went missing, they blamed it on Pepe. The earliest newspaper account we have is from 1867, but the most recent reports come from 2014. So this is something that's been going on for this long, long period. And it's ironic that Lake Pepin is the birthplace of water skiing as well.
And maybe there's a relationship there, but we can let somebody else figure that out. And whoever gets the $50,000, we will have them on Central Time to talk about that. Other monsters, we can talk about another new one for me, the gnomes of the Devil's Punch Bowl. I don't know. I know what a gnome is. I know vaguely what a punch bowl is. But you're going to have to put all these things together for me.
Right outside of Menominee, Wisconsin, not too far from UW-Stout campus, is the Devil's Punch Bowl, a beautiful area, hiking area, a waterfall, the rocks. Native Americans thought it was a sacred area. And for years, people have been going there hiking, just wonderful area, when all of a sudden they see what appears to be a wee folk, the little people, the gnomes, the goblins. And when they try to catch a glimpse, they turn around and these things either have darted back into the woods or disappeared right before their eyes. And I've talked to maybe half a dozen people who claim that when they were out hiking there, they too saw the little people of the punch bowl.
And finally, let's head back up north and talk about, I'm reading this, so I know it's real, the pancake-wielding aliens of Eagle River. And it's hard to say that without laughing. What are aliens doing in Eagle River, first of all, and why do they have pancakes?
Well, in 1961, local farmer Joe Simonton encountered this craft in the back of his yard, and he went out there, and then without anything being discussed, he knew they wanted water.
Mm-hmm.
The ship with these beings that he called looked like very small Italian men in a spacecraft, and he brought them water, saw they were cooking what appeared to be some pancake-type thing on a fireless grill, and they gave him three of these saucer cakes, as he called them. He ate one and said it was terrible, and he sent the other two off for analysis, and conspiracy theories are all over the board as to what happened with those other two, but he traded water for space pancakes.
And so those pancakes are probably in New Mexico someplace in a secret place, I would
think.
Yes,
they're right with the Roswell aliens.
Okay. So as time marches on, Chad, do we see the interest in monsters waning, or is this just a constant part of our life here in Wisconsin?
What I've seen over the last 20 years is not only do people want to hear about these things, read about them, then they want to go see them or try to experience them for themselves. And that's the newest tourism out there, is people going to these legend trips, these places where these monsters reside, and they want to see them. They want to come face to, well, not really face with these things.
All right. Monster tourism. Something else to put on my list. Chad, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, keep an eye out.
I will, too. You know I will. I'm absolutely going to do that. We've been talking with Wisconsin-based paranormal researcher Chad Lewis about Wisconsin's monsters.